Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and chair of this program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker for today's program. Jack Lissauer is a space scientist in the Space Science and Astrobiology Division, NASA Ames Research Center, Moffett Field, California. He is science co-investigator on the Kepler Space Telescope mission. NASA's Kepler spacecraft will search for Earth-sized planets orbiting distant stars following its launch in 2009. Lissauer is a consulting professor at Stanford, teaching advanced-level classes in planetary sciences and astrobiology. Lissauer and Mark Showalter of the SETI Institute, Mountain View, California, discovered two moons of Uranus, Mab and Cupid, as well as two additional rings around the planet, named with the Greek letters Mu and Nu. He led the effort to discover the sixth planet, Kepler-11 system, and co-led a project that verified 715 Kepler planets last year. It will be discussed today. Lissauer holds a doctorate in applied mathematics granted by the University of California, Berkeley, in 1982. His thesis is entitled Dynamics of Saturn's Rings. He also has a degree in mathematics from MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Some of his awards and activities include co-investigator on the Kepler mission and the transiting exoplanet satellite survey. Awards include the Harold C. Urey Prize, Division of Planetary Science of the American Astronomical Society, 1992, the NASA Honor Award, Exceptional Scientific Achievement Medal, 2013, American Geophysical Union Fellow, 2011, and the Chambliss Writing Award, American Astronomical Society, 2007. He has a graduate textbook, Planetary Sciences, now in its second edition, and has a second textbook for undergraduates, Terrestrial Planetary Sciences. Without further ado, Jack Lissauer.
Thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here at the Commonwealth Club, a place I have attended several lectures over the years myself. And it's also a pleasure to present to you results from the Kepler spacecraft, which has been a really amazing scientific mission over the past 6 years. And it's discovered over 1,000 verified planets to date, and an additional 3,000 plus candidate transiting exoplanets, and those candidates, probably about 90% of them represent true planets. Now, before I get into details about exoplanets or planets around other stars, I want to show you a little bit about planets in our own solar system. These are the eight largest bodies orbiting the sun. And I like this view because it emphasizes just how much larger the giant planets Jupiter and Saturn are from the four terrestrial planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars are. And also that there's really a third class of planets, the Uranus-Neptune planets, which are really intermediate in size. They're gas giants, but they're not really giants. They're intermediate bodies. The terrestrial planets are small, dominantly rocky. Jupiter and Saturn are mostly made of hydrogen and helium, the two lightest and most abundant elements in the universe, and the two primary constituents of the sun and most other stars. The intermediate planets, Uranus, Neptune, most of their volume is occupied by hydrogen and helium, which have very low density, but most of their mass is composed of heavier elements. Now, the giant planets look really dominant in this view, just comparing them with the terrestrial planets. But they're tiny compared to our sun. And this is really key to the fact that it is very difficult to detect planets around other stars. Planets are small, planets are dim, planets are distant, but actually the brightness, the amount of light coming off planets around some of the nearest stars is a lot more than some of the faint stars and galaxies that have been detected by large telescopes such as the Keck telescope in Hawaii and also the Hubble telescope in orbit about Earth. However, unlike these more distant faint objects, they are very close to something very bright, and therefore taking a picture of an extrasolar planet like Earth from our distance would be like photographing a firefly next to a searchlight that's in New York. Pretty hopeless. The only planets that have been imaged are much bigger planets orbiting relatively far from their stars. Because this direct detection technique is very difficult, the primary techniques that have been used for finding exoplanets, extrasolar planets, planets around other stars, same thing, are indirect. And the two most successful are radial velocity, which was the first technique to get a great deal of success, and that is looking at a star, looking at its spectrum, the wavelengths of the light that come out, and measuring very precisely the spectrum and how it changes with time. And the precision has gotten to be, for some bright stars, better than a meter per second. And that's a brisk walk. And this is by measuring differences in the wavelength of light, the speed of light is 300 million meters per second. So it changes in the wavelength by one part in 300 million. And hundreds of planets have been found this way. And the star's wavelength is changing because the planet isn't just orbiting the star, but as Newton showed, for every action there is an equal and opposite reaction. The planet goes around in one direction. The star, much bigger, much more massive, goes around a much smaller ellipse in the opposite direction. And that's what you're seeing. You're seeing the planet's response the star's response to the gravity of the planet. And just the amount that it moves towards and away from us, which is what changes the wavelength of light, just like when a siren is approaching you, it's high pitch. When it's going away, it's low pitch. Now, that's getting one component of the motion of the star. You might think that the motion of the star on the sky, motion relative to other stars that you can see just by taking pictures of the sky at different times, might be able to detect planets. And indeed, people have been looking for planets this way for more than a century and a half. And for any of you who are Chicago Cubs fans, you know that it's been a little over 100 years since they made it to the World Series. But take heart. Astrometrists have been looking for planets and actually announcing detected extrasolar planets for over a century and a half. And you might remember just about any age other than the youngest people here seeing headlines in the newspaper of the first planets around other stars found. And that could be if you're in your, if you're an octogenarian, if you're my age, if you're a little young, a couple decades younger, the first ones. Well, that's because the astrometrists have a track record that's more perfect and longer than the Chicago Cubs. They've never gotten it right. That's going to change, I think, in a few years with the European Hipparchos satellite, which is doing great work. The rest of the time, I'm going to be talking about a third method where you're also looking at the star, but you're not looking at the star's motion response to the gravity of the planet, but rather the star's light, which dims if the planet passes between us and the star. When the planet passes between us and the star, it blocks a little bit of the starlight. It's a partial eclipse, and that's known as a transit. Photometry is measuring the light of the star. And measuring the light of the star is a function of time. Seeing these dimmings when planets go in front is how the Kepler spacecraft has detected planets. And you can detect the planets and know how far they are from the star because, as Kepler showed just four centuries ago, Johannes Kepler, after whom our spacecraft is named, planet orbits around the star and the distance depends on, the period depends on the distance from the star. So you see this periodic blocking, different from a star spot or something like that, which is irregular. That pattern shows that it's transits. And transits can reveal planets as small as Earth. Now, they can only reveal planets if we're near the plane of the orbit of the planet. And the planes are randomly oriented. So we have to look at a lot of stars. For planets very close to the star, 1 in 10 transit. For planets at Earth's distance from their star, only 1 in 200 transits. Now, this is a picture of Venus transiting the sun seen in 2004. This was visible from Europe and from the east coast of North America. There was another transit in 2012, which was visible here. Many of you may have seen it. I don't have to check about the previous transit of Venus. None of you are old enough to have seen that. That was in the latter part of the 19th century. Well, in the picture of the transit of Venus, you could see a little disk in front of the star, in front of this our star, our sun. But that's not what we see with Kepler. We're just looking at the amount of light. So what's going on is seen in the top diagram, but we're seeing just the drop in light, and the amount that it drops depends the fraction of the star that the planet drops, that the planet blocks. Jupiter blocks one part in 101% of the light of the sun when it transits. Earth blocks less than one part in 10,000. So Jupiter-sized planets can be detected in transit from telescopes on the ground. But because the atmosphere varies a little bit, it's very difficult to detect small planets from the ground. Nothing can be detected as small as Earth from the ground in transit, or nothing has been with our current technology, at least. And that's why Kepler was launched. Now, Kepler is a moderate-sized spacecraft, much smaller than the Hubble spacecraft. It has a telescope mirror about 1 meter in size, and that's much smaller than Hubble. It's not designed for imaging, but it's designed with a very large focal plane. It's a CCD, but just like you have in your phone, but the focal plane, the area is much, much larger, so it's much more sensitive. It looks at a very wide field of view for a telescope that size. And it looks at an area a little bit off the Milky Way. We want to see a lot of stars. But we don't want the stars to be too close to one another and interfering with one another's light. And this is in the constellations of Cygnus and Lyra. Kepler was launched in March of 2009, and it was launched into an orbit that escaped Earth. It's orbiting the sun a little farther from the sun than Earth is. So Kepler's year is a week longer than our year, and that means it's going around a little less rapidly, and it's receding from Earth. But we're still able to hear from it until it runs out of gas and can't point and isn't useful. Now, Kepler has a very wide focal plane. It has 42 very large CCD chips on it, and ranged in a pattern such that it's symmetric, and Kepler, when it was doing its prime mission, observed in one position for 3 months, and then it rotated by 90 degrees so that the sunshade, could block the sun, and also the solar panels could be oriented towards the sun, but the same stars would be observed essentially all year long. Because we wanted to see the same stars many, many times to be able to detect 3, 4, 5 transits of planets with orbits of 1 year, planets that might be very similar to Earth. Now, the actual data are kind of messy. We have to do a lot of processing. But with them, with a lot of processing, we get the light as a function of time. And there are dips in these patterns of light as a function of time. With a Jupiter-sized planet, such as many of the first planets we saw, the dips are very clearly discernible. For a Neptune-sized planet even, like Kepler-4, the first planet we saw, Kepler-4b, first planet we verified, it's much harder to detect just by looking at the light curve. And for Earth-sized planets, you really need a lot of processing. Now, we've discovered thousands of candidate planets that have multiple transits, repeated patterns of similar depth and similar duration dips in the light curve. There are planets of different sizes, they would be planets of different sizes around stars of different sizes and different temperatures. Many of the stars are sun-like, but some of them are much larger, and some of them are quite a bit smaller. As I mentioned, we found over 4,000 candidate planets. And although most of the planets found, first planets found around other stars, the ones found from the ground, were Jupiter-sized. And Jupiter-sized planets are much easier for us to detect, because even a really noisy star, we can get Jupiter-sized planets. We're finding many more smaller planets. The peak are Neptune size in terms of what we see. But actually, we see almost as many intermediate in size between Neptune and Earth, about half of Earth size or even less, but still significantly larger than Earth. And even Earth size, we're starting to see a fair number. And because they're much more difficult to detect, we need the brighter stars where we get more light, or the smaller stars, or planets that are very close in so they transit many times and we can add up the signal from these many transits to detect them. What this implies are that the small planets are far more common than the large planets, especially close to stars where we're getting most of our data. Because recall that in addition to the transits being deeper for the bigger planets, the chance of there being a transit is much larger if the planet is orbiting the star close to the star, just from geometry. Because this planet has to be blocking part of the stellar disk from our view. Now, some stars have just one candidate planet, but many stars actually have more than one planet candidate. And over 400 have two planet candidates, close to 150 have three planet candidates, 50 have four candidate planets, 20 have five planet candidates, four have six planet candidates, and one has seven candidate planets. Oops, sorry about that. Microsoft moment. There we go. This chart shows the candidate planets as a function of their orbital period. And you can see most of the candidate planets we find have periods between a few days and a couple months. And also of their size, from smaller than Earth to larger than Jupiter. And the smallest planets that we're finding are the ones close in. That doesn't mean that all the small planets are close in. It just means close in we can see small planets and large planets, whereas farther away, there are just not enough transits, and you can't see them unless you have a lot of transits and you add all those little dips together. Now, this also shows that there are many multi-planet systems, and we can see the pattern of multi-planet systems. This is the size of the planet and their orbital periods, and we have hundreds of systems of three or more planets. And indeed, you can look and see, make a model called the Kepler-Orrery, which you can find by putting it into your browser and look at it on the web, and you can see the motions of the planets as they occur. This is from the little dips that we're seeing, and get how they are moving, what their phases are, what their times are, and it's really amazing that we have this many candidate systems. Now, I've mentioned candidate planets versus planets. And the reason is because there are false positives, binary stars, eclipsing binary stars, where one star comes in front of another star. And to people who search for transiting planets, especially doing so from the ground, eclipsing binary stars are the vermin of the skies. Most of the first searches for transiting planets from the ground, they found far more eclipsing binary stars than transiting planets. And you can, if you have two stars of comparable size, one coming right in front of the other, then you're going to get a much bigger dip than you'd get from a transiting planet. But if you have the orbit tilted such that you have a grazing eclipse, or if it's not a binary with the star that you're looking at, but just another star that's fainter and nearby on the sky, you can get dips similar to, in depth, to small planets going in front of stars. And that's why these are just candidates, unless we have additional reasons to think that they're planets. And that's also why most of the first planets we verify were large planets. There was a range of sizes because a greater effort was done to verify the small ones, but it was very difficult. At first, we had to observe these radial velocity variations, their pull on their star, and the response to their star, the star to the gravity of the planet, to be assured that they're real planets. Then we developed techniques to verify them based on slight changes in the period that were predictable because other planets in the system were perturbing them. And that's how we found most of the early small planets. And not only have we found planets smaller than Earth, Kepler was the first to do that around other stars, we found planets smaller than Mercury. And the smallest verified planet anywhere is Kepler 37b, which is only about the size of our moon. It's still much larger than Pluto, though. Yes, I know. Most people in the audience were of the age when Pluto was classified as a planet, but it's happened before. At the Commonwealth Club, you need to have a historical perspective. And in the 19th century, small objects were found, first series on the first day of the 19th century, and then three others within the next 7 years, orbiting between Mars and Jupiter. They were considered planets. And then, so people back then learned that there were 11 planets. Then right after Neptune was discovered, several more were discovered, and it was, getting up to around 15, and people said, no, these guys are too small. We're not going to count them as planets. They were demoted. And the same thing happened to Pluto. So that's the historical perspective. And in fact, even before the sun and the moon were considered planets, planets were the wanderers of the skies to the ancient Greeks. And it was actually Johannes Kepler who showed that they were different type objects. Copernicus had some ideas on this too, but they weren't too accepted until Kepler. That they were different objects, and Earth was became a planet. The sun and the moon were kicked out of the planet club. Anyway, most important thing, most people are interested in planets because we live on a planet. They're not as bright and shiny as stars, but we live on them, and we're most interested in planets, not big gas balls like Jupiter and Saturn, but planets like Earth. And not planets like Earth really close to stars where it's roasting hot, but small planets that are in what's called the habitable zone, the region from their star where they get an amount of energy comparable to the energy we receive from our sun, and therefore they might have if they have atmospheres like Earth, they could have liquid water on their surfaces, and they could be suitable abodes for living forms that are analogous to those of us who are in the room. We found a few. They're bigger than Earth. Many of them are warmer than Earth. Most of them are big enough that they could have some gases, significant, substantial gases, very, very thick atmospheres, below which it's very hot. But the smallest ones might be more Earth-like. And although we're not collecting data anymore because two of our gyroscopes broke and we needed three of our four gyroscopes to point at the field and keep taking data, we're still analyzing it and we're hoping to find some planets more like Earth. Well, next I'm going to tell you something about a system of planets that isn't really like our solar system. But it's a pretty amazing system. It's Kepler-11. It's the 11th planetary system viewed by Kepler. Actually, the first three weren't discovered by Kepler, but we were viewing them, so we gave them Kepler numbers. And it has six planets transiting in front of the star. And these planets are all larger than Earth. One of them just under twice the size of Earth. The others between 2.5 and 5 times the size of the Earth. But this little solar system is really compact. Five of the six planets orbit closer to their star than any planet orbits to our star. And the sixth one is pretty close in, too. It's closer than Venus, but is to the sun, but farther than Mercury. Now, the light curve, the function of light as we see amount of light we detect is a function of time. It has lots of variations because of the position, the scattered light from the sun, things like that, position of the detector. But these variations are mostly on monthly and quarterly times, and we don't worry about that. We flatten things out because we're interested in finding transits which have timescales of a few hours to maybe a day. So we flatten out the light curve, and then we look for the dips. And this star, Kepler-11, we found six sets of dips. And what we're seeing is just the light from variations in light from a star. But this pulsating of light, this blinking on and off, and then it really is showing, if we could look close in, we'd see planets orbiting in front of their stars, periodically come blocking their stars. And then if we could get outside the plane, look perpendicular from the direction that we see, we'd see these circular orbits of their planets. But from above the atmosphere, and it's spacecraft specifically designed to measure the light of over 100,000 stars every 30 minutes for 4 years. Very different, not pretty pictures, but wonderful data that tell us about planets. And this system, as I mentioned before, compact, very small compared to our own solar system. Now, we verified this system very early on because the planets are big enough and close enough that they're tugging each other, and the orbits are a period between 10 and a little over 100 days, and they're varying by a few minutes to a few tens of minutes from one orbit period to the next because they're pulling one another. And from that, we could not only confirm that they're planets and orbiting in the same star, but we could get, by the amount that they pull one another and the pattern of variations, we get the masses. And we have the masses and we have the sizes, so we could get an idea of their density. And these are very low-density planets. Small and lower density. They're like Uranus and Neptune, but less dense. They're a tight planet, a little bit like Uranus and Neptune, but not, but smaller, lower in mass. This is a pretty amazing system found in 2011, and there were all sorts of public things, like in the Central Valley, there was a corn maze cut in the shape of Kepler 11. Now, we have over 1,000 verified planets from Kepler. But the most interesting ones are where we have the masses and the sizes, because then we can have an idea of how dense they are and how much they're made of, what they're made of. And we found planets even less dense, lower mass, and bigger than the Kepler 11 planets. We found that this type of planet is actually pretty common. But there are also rocky planets bigger than Earth and denser than Earth. And there are giant planets in very close. There are planets in orbits of a little over 8 hours, roasting hot. Now, you have this image of diversity. And this is especially San Francisco. We cherish diversity. And people often think of this as diversity. Well, people aren't that diverse. We're all alike. This planets are much more diverse than people. And this would be a little closer view of the diversity of planets if you compare them to the animal kingdom, but even closer still if you add in to the animals, plants, and fungi, then you're getting a little bit closer to the idea of the diversity planets have. Let me tell you a little bit about a few of the planets that are especially interesting because they are analogous to Earth. Kepler-62f orbits a star only slightly smaller than the Sun. F means it's the fifth planet out. We don't use A. A is kind of for the star, and then B. So we start with B, C, D, E, F, etc. Kepler 11 has a sixth one, G. This one is 62F. We don't have any images. It's about 40% larger in radius, so about three times the volume of Earth. And We've seen some planets that size which are rocky. We think of Earth as a water planet because most of the surface is water, but it's less than 0.1% water by mass. So if you just have the mass and the radius, you wouldn't know that Earth was anything other than a rock. And you don't want a real thick ocean of thousands of kilometers that would actually change the density appreciably. You want a rocky planet. Even if you just want to live in the sea, you want to be not that far from the sea bottom. Well, Kepler-52f, similar in size to Earth, a little bigger, might be rocky, similar amount of energy that we get from the sun. So it's the first planet that we found, or that anybody found around another star, that there's any reasonable chance it's habitable. We've since found another planet a little bit smaller, so more likely to be rocky, but it's around a much smaller star and getting red energy may or may not be habitable. Red stars, these M dwarfs, tend to be very active for a long time, and this activity can cause an atmosphere to escape into space, an atmosphere of a small planet. So those are the first two planets probably that are potentially habitable around other stars. We're now seeing others which are comparably good candidates just recently, just slightly redder, and one is much redder and much fainter. It orbits the pair of stars and can actually diagram how we see the system edge on. We see the stars periodically eclipse one another. We see the planet go in front of the stars. And from that, we were able to get the mass and the size of the planet, because the planet is pulling the stars, so they don't orbit one another exactly periodically either. And it's very similar to Saturn in terms of its mass and size. And we've since detected about 10 other planets that orbit a pair of stars, circumbinary planets around a binary star that transit. Summarizing some of Kepler's key findings, planets, especially small ones, and by small I mean smaller than Neptune, smaller than the four giant planets in our solar system, are quite common, with more than 10% of the stars having planets, and it could very well be, it's probably true, that there are more planets in our galaxy than there are stars. Many of these planetary systems are flat. The planets orbit in nearly the same plane, just as the planets do in our own solar system. And that's why if you see planets there at night, they're along the line that the sun moves in the day, because our system is very flat. And the moon moves along the same line, very similar. Now, we only know that for other solar systems, for planets close to their stars, because that's what Kepler could see in 4 years and get enough transits and also the geometry. But there's no reason to think that that isn't true at greater distance. And as I mentioned earlier, planets and planetary systems are extremely diverse. Kepler is still up there. We can't point at the same area of sky to get more information and find smaller planets, but we can look at other areas, and we've been finding a few planets in other areas. On the horizon, scheduled for launch in less than 3 years, is NASA's next mission to search for planets around other stars, transiting other stars. TESS, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, very small spacecraft, will just be in orbit around Earth, high Earth orbit, to get a little away from the small satellites and some of the scattered light and the heat that you get orbiting Earth close in. And TESS will look, because it has four small cameras, they have very wide field of view, see a much broader area of the sky. And while Kepler did a pencil beam survey for one area of the sky to basically do a census by sampling of what planets are out there, TESS has a complementary mission. It's looking close in at the nearest and brightest stars. And the reason for that is the nearest and brightest stars, when you find planets transiting those stars, then you can do follow-up observations with other telescopes, both big telescopes from the ground like Keck and Hubble Space Telescope and the planned for launch being developed James Webb Space Telescope, and measure the primary constituents in the atmospheres and get additional important information about planets.
Okay. Thank Jack Listower for his talk this evening, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating its 113th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.